Okay, so on Sunday, I talked with you about the downward spiral of northern Israel that begins after the time of Jeroboam II. And tonight, what's going to happen is, by the end of tonight's class, we're putting the kibosh on northern Israel. It will be no more by the end of our Bible study tonight. One of the things, though, that I forgot to mention that I had intended to on Sunday is a scene where some of the books of the prophets fit in to our timeline. So just go with me for a moment before we go back to 2 Kings, and I want you to look with me at the start of these prophetic books, okay? So first of all, you may remember that the prophet Jonah is actually mentioned in 2 Kings in connection with the reign of Jeroboam II. And in the case of the book of Jonah, Jonah, of course, is told to go and preach to Nineveh. But we learn from 2 Kings that his time frame is this general time frame. If you have your Bible open to the prophetic books, if you go to Amos chapter 1, it says, "The words of Amos, who was among the shepherds of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah." We haven't talked about him. We have to skip some stuff. So we're going to briefly talk about him a little bit tonight. But Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. That's Jeroboam II. And then if you go back one book or so to, or a couple of books to Hosea, you can see in Hosea chapter 1 and verse 1, "The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah." We're going to talk about those guys tonight, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. So one of the things that it really helps me to do when I look at a timeline like this is to start plugging in where some of these prophetic books fit, and it just kind of helps me to see the connection between the books of the prophets and the historical time frame in which they were written. And we'll do some more of that, Lord willing, tonight. Okay, are you guys ready to clobber northern Israel tonight? So let me ask you to go back with me to 2 Kings, all the way back to chapter 10. Remember, this is Jehu, who basically goes on a rampage and wipes out anyone and anything in his way in Israel and Judah. If you've ever seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail, this is like Lancelot showing up at the wedding. That's basically Jehu. Anybody he sees, he's putting them out of commission. So as a result of that, in chapter 10, and I did not get much response back from that movie illustration. So I got to remember. So Haley, lights up. Finally, John, we're bonding now. Star Wars, nah. But Monty Python, now I know where to go. So that's good. Broadening our horizons for illustrations here tonight. So in chapter 10 and verse 30, the Lord told Jehu, "Because you've done well in carrying out what is right in my eyes, and have done to the house of Ahab according to all that was in my heart, your sons of the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel." So we had son number one, Jehoahaz. Then the next one, Jehoash. Then we've had our guy, Jeroboam II. And now we come to the fourth generation of sons, which is Zechariah, which is found here in 2 Kings chapter 15. So look with me over in chapter 15. And as you guys have noticed, we have spent most of the time in this part of our class focusing on the northern kingdom, and that's honestly because in the south things are relatively stable. And I mean, there are some things that happen that are violent. We'll see some of those even tonight. But where a lot of the action just takes place, that it's good to kind of have a handle on is really up in the north. So 2 Kings chapter 15 verse 8. "In the 38th year of Azariah king of Judah, Zechariah the son of Jeroboam reigned over Israel in Samaria." And how long does he reign? So 6 months. So this is going to be one of those where you know what's going to happen next when somebody has a tenure like that. It says, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, as his father had done. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, with which he made Israel to sin. And then it says in verse 10 that Shalom, the son of Jabesh, conspired against him and struck him down at Ibleam and put him to death and reigned in his place. So it's been a while since we've seen something like this. There had been, because of the promise made to Jehu, we had had these five generations altogether, Jehu plus the four generations, of some stability. But now that is in fact going to end. And so now we see the fulfillment of the word of the Lord as Shalom raises up this military coup and takes over. Yeah, Tommy. Sure. Tommy just asked a really good question that I don't have a for sure really good answer to, which is, did the Northern Kingdom practice? We know that they did some things obviously wrong. They set up those two golden calves, so they worshiped with idols, plus they also had Baal worship. But Tommy just asked, did they follow some of the other laws like Sabbath day observance, circumcision, dietary laws? My guess, and it's only that, Tommy, I have never in my whole life even thought about this. My guess is that they did follow a lot of those. Because some of those go all the way back to Abraham, like circumcision, and it's such a synonymous part of the identity of a child of Abraham to be circumcised. I would guess they did that. And I would imagine the dietary laws for the same reason, because that helps separate you from Gentiles. But there's another way we could answer that question, maybe. And we'll come to it at the end of class tonight. So when we get to, somebody remember this, I will not. When we get to the resettlement of Samaria, somebody say, hey, didn't you say you were going to talk about this again? And we'll talk about it then. But that's a great question. It's a great question. All right, now then, I want to show you something that it'll overwhelm me at first because it's going to be a bunch of names. Here are the final kings of northern Israel. So we just mentioned Zechariah, and then we just read about Shalom. We'll talk about all these more in just a second here. The reason I wanted to list all of these kings is everybody that I put in red, those are the people that all get assassinated. So what this tells you is of the final six kings of northern Israel, four of the six get assassinated. So this gives you an idea. It's almost like when we studied Judges and we talked about how there's like this spiraling that takes place. You almost have the same thing here in that the chaos and instability spirals in the final generations of northern Israel. After the line of Jehu is taken out, it's just basically a coup after another for the most part. All right, so if you look here in chapter 15, verse 13 says, Shalom, the son of Jabesh, began to reign in the 39th year of Uzziah, king of Judah. How long does he reign? Yeah, he's not quite as bad as Zimri, who lasted 7 days, but he only lasts for 1 month. And then, so when I was a kid, I learned this Menahem. But some of you are old enough to remember Menachem Begin, who was one of the Jewish prime ministers. This is basically his name. So if you want to sound really Jewish, Menachem, something like that. Get the phlegm going there, all right? So the son of Gadai came up from Tirza, which only a person with a weird memory for Bible trivia would remember was one of the early capitals of Israel. Jeroboam, the first Jeroboam, set up at Shechem. Then it moved to Tirza, and then it went to Samaria. So he's like kicking it back old school. He's going to come from one of the old capitals and stir up a revolt. He came to Samaria and struck down Shalom, the son of Jabesh, put him to death, and reigned in his place. So verse 15 says, the rest of the deeds of Shalom and the conspiracy he made, they're written in the book of the Chronicles, the kings of Israel. And then now we come to Menachem, and you can see he reigned 20 years. And he's in black, so he does not get assassinated. It says in verse 17, in the 39th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Menachem, the son of Gadai, began to reign over Israel, reigned 10 years. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart all the days from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, with which he made Israel to sin. Incidentally, you may notice that up on the slide, I have 20 years, and here I have 10 years. Just a side note. There is a lot of complications when you study the kings of Israel and Judah, and particularly when you study the years that are given for them. First of all, because sometimes from Chronicles to Kings, the years are different. And the most common reason that that is the case is that a lot of these kings practiced something that is called co-regency, which is to say that while they were still king, their son would reign with them as a co-regent, like co-king. And so sometimes what happens is you have overlapping periods of how long they might have been king. And it gets really complicated in a hurry, and it makes my head explode. That's why we've said virtually nothing about it in this class. You may even observe a couple more of these that come up like this. The other thing to remember is that, particularly in the case of northern Israel, where you have these generals who just decide, hey, I think I'm going to be king, you may have periods where one guy has control of one part of the country, but another guy has control of his part of the country, and they're doing that simultaneously. So it can get really complicated in a hurry. We're not going to fuss over it too much. Main thing I want you to see is he does actually have some tenure, and he even has a son who is able to reign and be king, but we got bigger problems. Who did you notice is mentioned in verse 19? The king of Assyria. Now, so far in the text, it has pretty much focused on Syria, which is immediately to Israel's north. But all during this period, another nation has been growing in its power and in its influence, and that is the nation of Assyria. And by this time in 2 Kings chapter 15, Assyria is becoming the dominant player in this part of the world. And in particular because of this king who, get your baby name idea books out and put this one in there, Tiglath-Pileser. That is a fantastic, that's like, you can just tell this is an ancient despot for sure. Tiglath-Pileser, and he's the third. So they ran with this one. They thought this name was great, let's just keep it going with this one. He's also given a nickname here in the Bible of Pul, but your Bible probably has a footnote that says this is Tiglath-Pileser III. And in fact, this map, can you all see the colors? Okay, do you see sort of orange in the middle and then green around it? Okay, so the orange is what Assyria was when he took over. The green is how much he expanded. And so he's starting to expand down into the region where the land of Israel is. And so you will notice here that as he expands the Assyrian kingdom, that Menahem here in verse 20 has to buy him off. This is what would happen. These powerful kings would show up. You pay me some money. It's like a protection racket in the mob. You pay us money, we'll leave you alone. And, you know, swear loyalty to us. So here's what you need then to just understand, that what dominates the final years of the history of northern Israel is this question: will we be pro-Assyrian or will we be against Assyria? That's going to be the issue. And if we're pro-Assyria, it means we got to pay them, but they'll protect us. If we decide to rebel, then we've got to be ready for war. And that's going to be the impulse here that shifts back and forth that is going to determine to a large extent what's going to happen. And not only in Israel, this will also become an issue in Judah as well, because those kings are going to have to make some of these same choices.
didn't the Lord strike Assyria down?
Yes. Dave's asking the point, and you're going to have to pardon me. I'm even more fuzzy-headed than normal because I did the lesson for Sunday already, and which was a huge mistake because they're just both now rolling around in my head. But we will talk about that, Lord willing, on Sunday. But yeah, we're going to get there. But the reason that that judgment comes that Dave is mentioning is because of this continuing growth as Assyria spills over and starts to spread south. All right, so Menachem does not have much of a dynasty. Notice what it says in 1523. In the 50th year, and just to point out, you can see one of the reasons why we didn't spend much time on the kings of Judah. These guys are reigning for like 50 years. There's relative peace, tranquility. It's up in the north where we have all of the excitement. In the 50th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Pekahiah, the son of Menachem, began to reign over Israel and Samaria. He reigned 2 years. So let me go back to this chart. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not turn away from, you'll never believe it, in a million years, the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, with which he made Israel to sin. And verse 25, so you can see Pekahiah is in red. Pekah, the son of Remaliah, his captain, conspired against him with 50 men of the people of Gilead and struck him down in Samaria in the citadel of the king's house, etc., put him to death and reigned in his place. And then, look at verse 27. In the 52nd year of Azariah, king of Judah, Pekah, the son of Remaliah, began to reign over Israel and Samaria. He reigned 20 years. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, with which he made Israel to sin. And look who shows up in verse 29. Once again, Tiglath-Pileser shows up and captures a bunch of cities. A lot of these are up to the north. Like you see, for example, Galilee is mentioned there, Naphtali. And then in verse 30, Hoshea, the son of Elah, made a conspiracy against Pekah, the son of Remaliah, and struck him down and put him to death and reigned in his place in the 20th year of Jotham, son of Uzziah. So as you can see here, Hoshea is going to be the final, he's going to be the final king of Israel here. And incidentally, in the Assyrian records, Tiglath-Pileser takes credit for this. He says that basically he bumped off Pekah and installed Hoshea to be a puppet so that he could basically control the nation. I don't know why. It's weird. Like, I'm always trying to find memory devices because I can't remember things, so I try to come up with these ridiculous ways to remember things. Hoshea. I don't know why, but when I was a kid, in my head, I said, Hoshea sounds like Osea, like Osei can you see, like the War of 1812, therefore he was the last king of Israel. I mean, I haven't ever figured out how did I connect those dots to get to that point, but it works because, I mean, to this day, I can tell you, Hoshea is the last king of Israel. So in the for what it's worth department, if you can do something with that, more power to you. If it makes no sense, I agree completely. I don't know why that happened, but it did. All right, let me ask any questions on these guys in the north. We're going to pause here before the final coup de grace comes, and we're going to go back up and talk about some of these, we're going to go south and talk about some of these kings in Judah just for a minute. But any questions up to this point? The big issue to keep in mind is the problem is Assyria. Are we firm or against them? Are we going to pay them money to leave us alone, or are we going to rebel? And which one is that going to be? All right, now then, let's think about these kings in the south. Look here in chapter 16. In the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, became king. We've had several kings since the last time we talked about the kings of Judah. Remember Jehoash, the frustrating guy who's the kid who's saved, but then at the very end of his life, he turned away. And then his son Amaziah and his son Uzziah, and then Jotham, and now we have Ahaz. Relatives to people, most of those kings are actually, they're pretty good kings. They're not the ideal, but they're pretty good until we get to this one. Notice what it says about him in 2 Kings chapter 16. Verse 20, Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. He did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord his God, as his father David had done. You've got the point by now that if I put on the final exam, how are the kings of Israel judged and how are the kings of Judah judged? The kings of Israel are judged in terms of their comparison to Jeroboam the son of Nebat, in which case they're all evil. Some just are even worse. In the case of Judah, they're all judged by David. He's the standard. And they either walk in the ways of David, but maybe they don't do a few things like take down the high places that Martha mentioned, asked about. Or sometimes they're terrible. And that's the case here with Ahaz. Notice what it says in verse 3. He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. He even did what? Yeah, he even practiced child sacrifice. So he upped the idolatry, and he even followed in paganism so much so that he practiced child sacrifice, what the Bible calls the despicable practices of the nation. And you would think a guy like this, the Lord would say, whatever happens to Judah couldn't be good enough for the terrible things that are going to happen to them because of this guy. But in fact, that's not the case. So here's what happens, and this will be a throwback to last year when we studied the book of Isaiah, because a lot of the book of Isaiah focuses on this event. So you might want to turn to 2 Kings 16, but also you may want to turn to Isaiah chapter 7 and see how these two accounts go together. So here is what happens. Because Assyria is growing, and they're so much more powerful than any of these small kingdoms down to the south, Syria, Israel, and Judah. If you are going to rebel, you're not going to be able to do it alone. So what you need to do is you need to find allies and join forces and rebel together. So the king of Syria, whose name is Rezin, and the king of Israel, we've already met him, his name is Pekah, send word down to the king of Judah, who is Ahaz, and they say, hey, join us and fight Assyria. Ahaz says, not going to do that. In fact, I'm going to be friends with Assyria. So then at that point, guess what Rezin and Pekah decide to do? We're going to attack Judah, because the last thing we need is an ally of Assyria down here on our southern flank. So let's go attack them and get rid of them. So this is called the Syro-Ephraimite War. Why did they come up with that name? It was like in American history, the French and Indian War is not a war between the French and the Indians. It's the French and the Indians attacking America and the British colonies. So Syro-Ephraimite War, it's called that because in this case, Syria and Ephraim, which is the largest, most powerful tribe in northern Israel, joined forces together. So that's called the Syro-Ephraimite War. Takes place in the 730s, 730s BC. And so it pits Judah, led by King Ahaz, wicked, wicked king, against Israel, led by Pekah, and Syria, led by Rezin. So notice what it says here in 2 Kings chapter 16 and verse 5. Then Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to wage war on Jerusalem. And they besieged Ahaz, but could not conquer him. And their intent was, knock him out, replace him with somebody else, and then they can be our allies. And so then notice in verse 7, to whom does Ahaz turn for protection? Exactly right. He sends messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come and rescue me. And then notice carefully in verse 8, what does he send to seal the deal? Sends treasures from the temple. So remember the point we made, was it on Sunday that I made the point? You can know all you need to know about Judah by looking at two houses, the house of David and the house of the Lord, the Davidic dynasty and the temple. And what's happening with one is with the other. So if you look in the house of the Lord and you see children being sacrificed, well, that tells you all you need to know about what's going on in Judah. Not to mention now treasures being shipped off. We've seen this happen already several times. And I pointed out to you, it's almost like a foreshadowing of the ultimate sending away of the treasures of the temple, which will happen at the end of the book when everything is taken and the temple is destroyed. But that's what Ahaz does here to get some help. Now then, this is the time of the prophet Isaiah. So hold your place here and go over with me. First of all, let me ask you to look in Isaiah 1. Most of the time, you know, the prophets give us the dates for their books. Hey, you know, y'all have heard me say it's much better to be lucky and a good guesser. That's the way to go. And I'm saying that sort of tongue-in-cheek. So I got to tell you this story. When I was a senior at Florida College, back in those days, the Bible program was not accredited. It was very rigorous, but it didn't have the official seal of approval. So instead of officially a bachelor's degree, you got something called the Certificate of Achievement, which sounds like an attendance award for elementary school. But anyway, that's what I have hanging in my wall, Certificate of Achievement. But one of the things that you had to do to graduate is you had to do what would be called an oral comprehensive exam. And the way that it worked is you went upstairs to the second floor of the administration building, and all of the faculty and the Bible faculty sat in the room, and you went in and they asked you questions. So it was a very intimidating procedure. Cassie, did you have to do that? Yeah, my certificate is worth more than your. So anyway, and you're going to be quizzed over 4 years worth of stuff. So, I mean, how do you even prepare for this? So the last few minutes before I went up to face my inquisitors, I happened to look, and I had on a shelf in my room in North College a little workbook by Robert Harkrider on the book of Isaiah. And I got it down, and I went and I flopped down on my bed, and I opened it up to introduction. And it said, the kings of the time of the prophet Isaiah were Uzziah, Jotham, and Ahaz and Hezekiah. And then it was time for me to leave. And so I went upstairs, I sat down, and my great teacher, Phil Roberts, said, "Oh, so Shane, tell me, who were some of the kings of the time of the prophet Isaiah?" And I said, "Well, of course, that's Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah," which I would not have even had a clue but I just happened to read it right before I went up there. So always pays to be a good guesser and be lucky if possible. But, in seriousness, when I talk about being a good guesser, it's just like it's knowing what to look for is really what I'm talking about here. So anyway, every time I think about Isaiah 1:1, I just always think about that story in my life. So the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amos, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. So that's the time frame. And then if you go over to chapter 7, it tells us about the Syro-Ephraimite War. It says in verse 1, "In the days of Ahaz, son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah, Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up against Jerusalem to wage war against it. And so it was told to the house of David, Syria is in league with Ephraim. And the heart of Ahaz and the heart of the people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. And the Lord tells Isaiah, go out to meet Ahaz, you and Shear Jashub, your son, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the washer's field. And say to him, be careful, be quiet, do not fear, and do not let your heart be faint because of these two smoldering stumps of firebrands. They are all smoke, no sizzle," the idea here, "at the fierce anger of Rezin in Syria and the son of Remaliah. Because Syria with Ephraim, the son of Remaliah, has devised evil against you, saying, let us go up against Judah and terrify it. Let us conquer it for ourselves." And we actually learn the name here of the guy they intended to replace Ahaz with, the son of Tabeel, as king in the midst of it. And what the Lord says, you basically tell them within just a few years, these guys are not even going to be around anymore. They're going to be conquered. This is the context, though, where one of the most famous messianic prophecies in the Bible comes from. Because the Lord says to Ahaz, you know what? Ask for a sign, and in this case, I'll give you one. And then Ahaz says, oh, I could never put the Lord to the test. They're one of the most phony people in all of the Bible. And the Lord says, I'm going to give you a sign anyway. And here it is. Behold, the virgin will conceive and bear a son, call his name Emmanuel. And that's where that prophecy comes from. It's in this context here of the Syro-Ephraimite War. Okay, but the problem is Ahaz has a choice to make. Do I trust in the Lord to deliver us, or do I put trust in what I can do by hiring out the king of Assyria? And he puts his trust in the king of Assyria. Now, this is always hard. It's always hard to trust in the Lord when it sure seems like you could just handle things yourself and just do it your way. But that's what King Ahaz chooses to do. All right, everybody good? See how Isaiah fits into all this? This would be the time frame of Isaiah. And also, if you went and looked at the prophet Micah, Micah would be a prophet around this time. Let me skip ahead just a second so I can show you on the timeline. Sorry, I'm not there yet. Forget all that. Rewind the tape. We'll get to it here at the end of class. All right, any questions, though, on the Syro-Ephraimite War? Syria and Ephraim, Israel, against Judah. All right, so back to 2 Kings chapter 16. Thing I want you to see, Reagan or John, be sure Reese gets this one too, adds it to his list. Who would have ever thought the Lord wants to help Judah with a king like Ahaz? But he does, because more is at stake than just Ahaz. The house of David is at stake. Because if these guys come down and replace Ahaz, they're not going to replace him with his son. That'd be ridiculous. They intend to replace him with somebody who's not a part of the Davidic dynasty. There are bigger fish to fry than Ahaz, and that's why the Lord is going to intervene. And that's so often why the Lord intervenes in stories that don't make sense to us. There are bigger purposes that are at work here. All right, after this happens, Ahaz makes friends with the king of Assyria. We get more detail about the kind of evil Ahaz is capable of. So you go back to chapter 16. Verse 10 tells us that he meets with Tiglath-Pileser at the city of Damascus, and he sees an altar at Damascus. And it says in verse 10 that King Ahaz sent to Uriah the priest the model of the altar and its pattern, exact in all its details. So, you know, when you're doing your daily Bible reading and you get to Exodus 25, and then it starts in with all of the details about the construction of the tabernacle, and then you give up, or you want to, because it's a lot of extraneous detail, it seems like. And you know that every item in the tabernacle and temple was built to exact specifications of the Lord. Well, you'll notice that Ahaz, in like a perverse version of that, now has another altar, a pagan altar, built to the exact details that he saw. And in verse 14, the bronze altar that was before the Lord, he removed from the front of the house, from the place between his altar and the house of the Lord, and put it on the north side of his altar. And then gives instructions for his altar to be used in verse 14. And then in verse 17 and 18, he basically just starts redoing everything that Solomon did. So remember I said, if all you had was a security camera on the temple, you just look at what's happening, it tells you what you need to know about the kings. So here is a guy who is literally trying to undo and redo everything that Solomon did when he built the house of the Lord, which I think is a fitting symbol of his desire to please the king of Assyria rather than to please God in the way that he's handling things here. Okay, so let me go back over here now to our chart. Are you all ready now, finally, to put the kibosh here on Assyria? I mean, on Samaria, northern Israel. So I haven't put any years up here for a long time. You're totally seeing my biases. I'm not a numbers guy. We haven't done many dates, haven't done any really in a long time. And we haven't fooled with any chronological details because it makes my head hurt. But here is a date you would probably want to remember, 722. 722. So if you go back, anybody remember, just on the off chance, say that. So Alan is, he's got 1010 locked down. That's David, right? So we've got that one on the lockdown. All right, anybody happen to remember the approximate date of when the kingdom divides? It's okay, we haven't talked about it in a long time. It's approximately the year 930, 931, right in through there, okay? So what that means is what we have covered in just a few classes is about 200 years of Israel's history. And now northern Israel, their history is about to cease as a political entity, and it's going to take place in the year 722, okay? It's found for us in 2 Kings chapter 17. 2 Kings chapter 17. Initially, Hoshea, can you see, the last king of northern Israel, he is a pro-Assyrian king at first. It says in verse 3, this is chapter 17, verse 3, against him came up Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, and Hoshea became his vassal, paid him tribute. But the king of Assyria found treachery in Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, and offered no tribute to the king of Assyria as he had done year by year. And so as a result of that, big mistake, after turning against Assyria, Assyria invades. Initially, the invasion is done by Shalmaneser V. They want to take Tiglath-Pileser's sons, and then mysteriously, his brother Sargon II takes over. And there's a lot of conspiracy theories as to whether maybe he bumped off his brother or not. But it is during the time of Sargon II that the nation of Israel falls and that the city of Samaria is captured. Verse 6, in the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria, and he carried the Israelites away to Assyria and placed them in these various cities. There's actually a lot of archaeology from this time frame because the Assyrians were prolific in making monuments with inscriptions that describe the things they do. This is a relief. You can see the Assyrian soldier with a mace, and you can see captives who are being led away into exile. This is exactly what the Lord warned over and over again would happen. In fact, if you were going to go back to a passage in the law that spelled out penalties that would happen if you were disobedient, you would go back to Deuteronomy 28. That's our key chapter. And in Deuteronomy chapter 28, verse 36, the Lord specifically said, if you break the covenant, I will take you out and take you far away from here. Beyond the Euphrates, I'll take you away. And that is now exactly, that is exactly what is going to happen. Not only that, if you look at verse 24, you can see it was the policy of the Assyrian kings to resettle captive populations. So they take Israelites, ship them out, and then they take captives from other nations and bring them in. Why do you think they would do that? That's exactly right. To keep an uprising from happening, because the people who would rise up are going to be the patriots of Israel. Well, ship them out. Bring these other people in from other nations, and their theory is that'll make these people less likely to rise up because they're not fighting for their land. They're in a strange land. Anyway, why even fight? So that's exactly what the Assyrians did. They tended to resettle. Fortunately, these ancient kings love to brag about the things that they do. So Sargon brags about this in something called the Nimrud Cylinder. He says, at the beginning of my royal rule, and basically his first year as king was 722, the town of the Sumerians I besieged and conquered for my God. I led away 27,000 and so forth inhabitants. The town I rebuilt better than it was before. I'm great. I made it even better. So better Samaria than before. And settled therein people from countries which I had conquered. And as we all know, that gives us the backstory behind. I said, as we all know, that gives us the backstory of tumbleweed blowing through the auditorium. It gives us the backstory of the Samaritans. This is why the Samaritans were considered half-breeds and despised by the Jewish people, because the people that come in from these foreign countries who are resettled are going to intermarry with the Israelites who are left and produce a new race that the Jews considered a mongrel race, and the race is going to get the name of the region, and the region gets its name from the main city, and the main city is Samaria. So this is the Samaritan. So now you know, anytime you teach about the parable of the Good Samaritan or the other references in the New Testament to the Samaritans, like in John 4, the Samaritan woman, if you want to be able to go back to the biblical background for where that people group originates, this is it right here. And if we had more time, we would talk about their different religious practices that come up. And this was Tommy's question. So my guess is that a lot of the things of the law, they tried to keep. But here would be the way, Tommy, to investigate your question more specifically. There are still a few hundred Samaritans left. They have a yearly religious calendar different from the Jewish calendar. If you went online and searched for the Samaritans, you would find a description of whatever their current religious practices were. And it would really be interesting to see how many of them are similar to the law of Moses. Maybe not identical, but similar to the law of Moses. I'm assuming they would have still practiced some kind of circumcision and some kind of dietary code. I'm totally guessing that. I don't really know. So that'd be a good research question, Tommy, for you to find out. And we cannot wait to get your report back on Sunday when you track all of that down. All right, so that's 722, the fall of Israel with the last king, who is Hosea. What we might do on Sunday is pick up, there is a wonderful section here in 2 Kings 17 where the Bible historian gives commentary on, here's why this happened. And he quits preaching and goes to meddling. And the thing that you'll want to pay attention to when you get to that section is how many of these things that Israel did are things Judah has done or is doing. Because if this is what got Israel the heave-ho, it's going to have the same consequences for Judah as well, unless they repent. So, but now at this point, it will be Judah alone. Okay? All right, thank you all so much. We had a lot to get through tonight, and by the skin of our teeth, we just about did it.